Those of you who recently read our Garmin UK blog will know that we spoke about the importance of running on our mental health. And it's so important at the moment that we stay on top of our mental health. Running is about so much more than the physical benefits we get. We run to help our emotional stability, to maintain a sense of normality and control and rhythm in our lives. It helps us wrestle with tensions, concerns, anxieties, settle some emotions, stay on top of our thoughts and feelings. And we thought it would be a really good idea to talk with Dr. Simon Marshall, author of The Brave Athlete, performance psychologist, former professor of behavioral medicine at the University of California in San Diego, and founder of Brave Heart Coaching. Nice to see you, Simon.
Good to see you, Martin, and hi all the way from sunny California.
Yeah, well, of course, you're in similar situation to us at the moment, and running and exercise, certainly the way in which we consume it has just shifted temporarily, we hope.
Yes, it certainly has. All of us who are sort of exercising nuts, we've all struggling with the changes in circumstances, but there are ways through it. And fortunately for most of us, running's actually been our little anchor, our little sort of flag in the sand that keeps us sane. So we're grateful more than ever to be runners.
What do you think it is about running that makes it so good for your mental health?
Yeah, well, it's a sort of a loaded question and a complicated question. Scientists have really only picked up the scent of how running improves our mental health somewhat fairly recently in the scope of sort of the scientific study of exercise. And to be fair, it's not just running. We've studied a whole bunch of different exercises, aerobic exercises, pitting that against resistance and strength and other sorts, as well as, is it the context that matters? Is indoor exercise better for your mental health than outdoor exercise? And unfortunately, in the real world, it's really hard to isolate all of these different effects to know which kind of is the best combination. But we do know that when we study consistently, we see not just physical changes in the brain happening. There are a whole bunch of like neurological and biochemical changes that help regulate mood and memory and learning and restore positive affect or positive mood. Mm. But there are whole areas that we know of science now that focus on the study, like, for example, the social aspects of running and having to do things with a group, the accountability, the sharing, and all the sort of special sauce of doing things in groups. So we know that there's lots of elements that are really helpful for us. And the good news is that there are virtually no side effects. Obviously, you could take that to the extreme with chronic overuse and overtraining, but for the vast majority of the population, it's sort of one of these forms of exercise that's both medicinal, therapeutic, and training, and it's really with no side effects. It's kind of a win, a good bang for your buck.
Often we think of you know, the physical benefits first, but of course it really does improve your brain health. You know, tell us a little bit about that.
What's happening? Yeah, well, the good news is that body and brain are actually part of the same thing. Shock, phew, horror, right? So when we talk about mind, mental health and mindset, a lot of the mechanisms, or at least the mechanisms that are being proposed by scientists, have a biological basis. So one of those, for example, is how aerobic exercise and running that's been studied in particular promotes what we call neurogenesis, right? The development of new brain cells that help us do a whole bunch of different things, like how do we think, how do we function, how do we make decisions, how do we think creatively and innovatively, and so on. So there are some like interesting biological mechanisms that are driving that, some little sort of kind of obscure neurotropic factors that get released, these epigenetic changes that facilitate brain growth.
What does epigenetic mean?
I know, right? So for example, we've known in fairly recently that we always thought that we sort of turn genes get turned on and off to do and different tasks or do different things in the body. But we now know the physical environment or other things that we do has the ability to flick that switch for us. So really epigenetic really means that how we turn genes on and off, not just that happen naturally, part of the sort of aging process of the body, but also how the environment physically changes it. So there's lots of interesting biological research coming out of neuroscience and cognitive neuroscience about sort of the neurological and physiological underpinnings of brain health in response to exercise. But we know that it goes far beyond that. And of course, how many of us run thinking, oh, I'm getting good brain-derived neurotrophic factor? We don't do that. No, nobody in their right mind, unless you're a real science nerd, thinks like that. But we do think well, I actually feel a bit better. I'm less frustrated, sure. I'm less angry, and so on. But when the scientists drill down into what is it that actually promotes and improves mood, we actually go back to these biological mechanisms. So this is really how the brain, our mindset and our sort of brain chemistry are so intertwined.
And so we've got those longer term brain health benefits. We've also got those shorter and often immediate benefits, the kind of day-to-day stuff, you know, the reasons like, okay, I just need to go for a run today. I really need to go. I really need that run in, you know, let's talk about it. Yeah. Let's talk about some of those, like some of those really important immediate benefits that we can get, you know, because once we understand the importance of how they can shape our running, I think then we can pay more attention to them when we run. So I mentioned at the beginning, you know, one of the benefits for me personally is that, you know, when I go for a run, it gives me an opportunity to just process emotion a little bit and regulate that emotion.
So the way that particularly for people in my world, like performance psychologists, think about these sorts of effects is that it comes back to stress management. One of the things that comes back to is stress management. And we know that humans tend to gravitate towards one of two strategies to cope with stress. And a stressor being some external, it can be an internal event as well, that causes, knocks us out of homeostasis, right? I feel bad, I want to feel better again. And so on. And so the two methods, and this is the little clue here about why exercise and running in particular is just like magical for stress management. One is that we tend to gravitate towards a problem-focused coping strategy. Mm-hmm. And so when we face with a stress, a problem-focused coping method targets the source of the stress itself. It makes the stressor smaller. So we get busy at work. What do? We work harder, we work longer hours. We're making the work that we have to do that's causing a stress less. So we're reducing the stress at its source. Mm-hmm. Conversely, emotion-focused coping, the other type of coping strategies, are when all we're doing is we're changing the filter, how we think about what this means to us. So now I won't be targeting my metaphorical in tray by making the problem go away, but by exercising, I can just feel better. Meditation is another great form of emotion-focused coping. People drink or eat fat and sugar, emotion-focused coping, right? The problem feels different, but the problem hasn't gone away. So with exercise, it actually is one of the few coping mechanisms that do both. And all of the coping and the stress coping literature tells us the best stress managers are people who do both problem and emotion focused coping. So how does exercise and running in particular do this? Well, we all know the emotion focused coping advantages. I just need to blow off steam. I need time to think about things and just like get away. If you're in a busy house with lots of children, you just want to get away from it, leaving your poor partner to cope.
Yeah, but it's like that concept of I need some me time. I need some space.
Absolutely.
You know, I just need to go out and get this run done. And I know when people frame it, don't they? And they say, well, I'll just be better. I'll just feel better when I come back. And so what you're doing is you're saying you're not making that up. You know, there's some rigor and science behind that.
There is. In fact, there's a whole system in the body called the endocannabinoid system, a biological system that helps restore homeostasis when things are out of whack.
Isn't that a galaxy in Star Wars, Simon?
Yeah, that's like Battlestar Galactica. Come on, show you. We know that it sort of excites the endocannabinoid system so that we do get some of these kind of health protective restorative effects biologically happening. But the issue with exercise and the main, like the fantastic thing about exercise is that, yes, it helps us cope with emotion as an emotion-focused coping method, but it also helps us solve problems, problem-focused. So most runners can relate to this, that you've got this particularly challenging thing, problem that you're trying to deal with. It might be a work problem. It might just be a thing that's bugging you. It might be even a home improvement thing that you've been struggling for a while to do. If you're a writer or an author and you've got, you know, sort of writer's block, we go away, we blow off steam, we feel better, endorphins, all these other physical effects that help us with this emotion-focused coping. But we also know that we can come back and we've suddenly been able to look at a problem in a new way, right? And so we can all attest, if you do write for a living or have to write for a living, you come back and the problem you've been struggling with, how to frame this or phrase that, suddenly seems to be a bit better. So we think, for example, some of the research shows that innovative and creative thinking changes as a consequence of aerobic exercise and running in particular.
Wow. So what does that mean for us? Like at the moment, is there a duration around this? Do I need to exercise or run for a particular amount of time or particular intensity to get those benefits? Do I need a history of exercise to get those benefits? Do I get more of them the more I do? Yeah, how does it work? Yeah.
All great questions, and I wish that we had the answers to all of those questions. We don't. We do know some fairly general rules that are fairly good sort of rules of thumb to use. So one is that to have the mental health or the emotion boosting effects of exercise. So I'm not talking about dealing with sort of clinical issues like if you've got depression or anxiety, how does exercise help or so on, but for general health protective effects of exercise for our mental health, the recommendations, the national recommendations we have, not just in the US, but in the UK, they're fairly consistent. 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise a week or 75 minutes of vigorous seem to be in the ballpark of getting those mental health effects. Now, what does the evidence tell us about doing longer exercise? So, for example, some of the studies using sort of brain-derived neurotrophic factors or some of these neurogenic factors, they seem to be like 90 minutes of vigorous exercise about has to be. So some really long, intense exercise bouts for some to get some of these effects that last at least 4 to 8 weeks. So the science really does, it depends is the answer. As a general rule, it's a good idea to say, well, listen, we'd like to try and be doing some aerobic exercise, most preferably all days of the week, right? This comes back to physical activity messaging. 30 minutes, but if you can't do 30 minutes in one go, even bouts as short as 10 minutes still seem to be mentally health stimulating. Mm. So there really aren't any sort of hard and fast rules that, well, 11 minutes is better than 9 minutes. No, all of these thresholds are somewhat arbitrary as far as the science, or at least that they capture the majority of benefits. And scientists tend to try and shy away from being too precise simply because we know that the science isn't as precise as that.
But it sounds like, you know, actually, you know, getting out and moving and running or doing some aerobic activity, you know, really helps you fight negativity, perhaps feelings, accept, manage those feelings, come back and have allowed running to kind of be a little bit of magic in your life when you need it the most.
It is. So if you run and you get into the zone, or we often talk about in our book, we talk about the computer brain, the sort of all the part of your brains that regulate automatic processes like walking and running or automatic behaviors. We don't have to think too much. We can actually zone out a bit. We can sort of down-regulate or sort of not listen to or take up bandwidth from the internal chatter that we have from both our frontal cortex, the rational, logical, over-analysis part of you, but also the emotional thinking part of you, our limbic system that's giving us where all our emotions are coming from. So thinking and emotion, like negative, hard emotions to deal with and overthinking, are both things that running and aerobic exercise can help with. We think because different parts of our brain kick in or take over as we do repetitive, rhythmical activities. And that doesn't seem to be the case for all sports, as you know. Like playing a target sport or playing a team sport where the attentional demands are quite different than a sort of almost like an auto-hypnotic activity like swimming or biking or running, seem to convey a whole different set of mental health outcomes or benefits that are quite unique to those sorts of activities.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like, you know, there's a real opportunity with our running to use it to cope with that uncertainty. And particularly if you're feeling uncomfortable about something, you know, and work with that emotion a little bit. Is there anything else that you think, okay, these are important things to put in place around running if you really, or exercise, you know, if you really want to try and optimize some of those benefits, if you're really thinking about what can I do with the running that I'm able to do to keep me, you know, feeling more stable and feeling less uncertain, more certain, I guess. There you go.
Yeah. Well, it does. So an uncertainty is a good example. And there are few psychological states that are more damaging to the human spirit than uncertainty. It's far more damaging than disappointment. as any athlete who has broken something, a bone, knows, versus being diagnosed with a chronic illness or a chronic disease or chronic fatigue, or am I ever going to feel better? Is this it for me? Versus you break a leg. I know the treatment plan. I know that when I can be off crutches. And so dealing with disappointment is far easier to cope with uncertainty. And quite unique things happen in the brain under conditions of uncertainty, which is one of the reasons we know that it's used, it's been weaponized in psychological torture, interrogation, solitary confinement, all methods to leverage the brain's inability or unwillingness to cope with uncertainty about what's going to happen. And so one of the reason why uncertainty is so difficult for the human brain is because most of our biological mechanisms to cope with stress are built on anticipation. They're anticipatory. So we think about what things could happen, and that sets off a cascade of reactions, some of which are pleasurable. We get these dopamine spikes that make us feel good, that make us want to continue, but also bad things, right? When you put humans under high conditions of uncertainty, they tend to ruminate and worry a lot more. Other species don't do this, by the way. We think that other species, they just respond to uncertainty with vigilance. They become more hyper-aware of threat cues in their environment that might mean that food is going to be more restricted, sex might be restricted, or so on. But humans have this rather unique ability to do mental time travel when they're under uncertainty. Why is this happening? What could happen? And we go down rabbit hole after rabbit hole of thinking usually about all of the worst case scenarios, because we have what we call a negativity bias. In brain world, our brain really weights negative information 4 times greater than positive information. And this is a good little rule of thumb, actually, for any of us who want to feel better. I know that I have to outweigh the negative stuff by about 4 to 1 to have a good chance of having some good mental health. So uncertainty is brutal. So running when we have a chance, or we have an activity that we can control the uncertainty. And again, it's no surprise here that the antidote to uncertainty is certainty. How can I have some certainty in my life? And this comes back to structure, routine, and rewards that I can have, always have some control over. And that's where humans will naturally gravitate towards. So what we always recommend, and certainly the athletes that I deal with, and whether it's your condition, whether you have a condition of I'm injured and I don't know whether I'm going to be better, I have an illness, I don't know whether that's going to clear up, I might be under this bizarre circumstances of COVID-19 and when that's going to improve, all along the treatment or the recommendations are still the same. How can I have wrestle control back to things that are in my say, in my sort of personal control? And that usually is about how I manipulate structure and the routine and the rewards I get back. So these anticipation mechanisms, how our brain is biologically wired to respond to nice things and bad things, has a fighting chance of getting you through it.
And that, you know, what strikes me with that is that there's an element of hope, you know. So in a sense, when you run and you put structure and routine together with regular physical activity, in this case running, but it doesn't have to be, it could be working out at home, then it can facilitate hope.
Absolutely. And it's funny, because as athletes, rarely do we think about our mental health the same way we do about the training metrics, right? So most of us who run, either run competitively or train competitively, are all too familiar with all of the little ways that we try and measure training load and training responsiveness and so on. We know, you know, for example, there's a whole bunch of things that we try to get better at and coaches try and get us better at doing, but we don't do the same for our mental health with regard to exercise.
Right.
But psychologists have identified some quite key concepts that give us clues that there are some things that seem to be as important in terms of what's the mental equivalent of a, you know, a threshold heart rate, right? What's the equivalent am I doing to improve my mental health? And so there's this concept of psychological capacity. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but psychological capacity. And it's sort of the equivalent of mental health for people who don't have existing mental health conditions or illnesses. But it's like, how do I optimize overall mental health? How do I know if I'm a mentally healthy person? How do I sort of measure it? How do I know if I'm improving? And so this notion of psychological capacity, of which hope is one of the 4 elements, right? Having hope is critical. Another one is having, being optimistic. There's a lot of literature now about why optimism is improves your immune function. But the difference, and I want to come back to hope because it's absolutely critical. Optimism as a sort of a personality temperament. Do I think things are going to turn out okay, right? We all have, most of us are glass half empty, half full kind of people. That seems to be a fairly stable trait that we have in us. And there's science about how we can improve it and where it comes from. But suffice to say that our optimism, we don't play a key role in that. So we can be really optimistic, but I do nothing about how things are going to turn out. I don't actually become engaged in the problem. I don't try and solve the things that are difficult. I can just be an optimistic person and still be a passive sort of participant in how things turn out. But hope, like optimism, do I think things are going to turn out well, puts you as an athlete or a human front, dead center in that relationship. And this is why it's a really key part of psychological capital. So what this means is, how do we actually become instrumental in building hope? We do it through setting goals, right? This is really why goal setting and athletes in particular love having things to work towards, because we can see a pathway, right? So this isn't just willpower. This is what we call way power. I see a pathway to have the outcome that I want. So goal setting becomes critical in that. Another one that we've learned is how I actually improve the effectiveness of goals. How do I improve the likelihood of me saying, I want to do this, I will do this, but we know it doesn't translate that much into doing, if we believe the research on you know, intentions going through into action. But there are some small things to build hope that we can do. And one fantastic one, for example, is instead of thinking about your goal, whether it's running or training, or it's a finite period that you know isn't going to last very long, instead of thinking about the goal that you want to achieve, you actually focus on the biggest obstacle or barrier to you reaching that goal. And you goal set around the obstacle or reducing the barriers. And if you do this one small thing, we think you can double the likelihood of you actually doing it. It sort of doubles, it makes it more potent, that intention, I want to, I will to, becomes more potent. So hope is an absolutely critical pillar of actually having good mental health. And when you dig beneath the surface, it's now, am I setting goals towards what I want to do? Smart goals, but also am I actively focusing on the things that are going to stop me meeting that goal? Elements of hope.
How do you monitor things like that? You know, is there a way, you know, that you could perhaps use accessible metrics to give you some feedback, you know, some wearable
about
metrics,
how your mental health is or how you're feeling?
It's like, so I don't know, like your stress levels or your sleep levels, or you know, something that's helping you go, okay, this is an indicator for me, and I'm able to track it and I'm able to monitor it, and therefore by association, you know, I know that I'm improving my physical health. I'm also able to, you know, identify those key metrics, those key factors, and track what I hope will be an improvement in my mental health, even if I don't identify mental health issues, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And in fact, all of the, you know, companies that are developing software to help train athletes are all trying to find, it's a bit, you know, like the movable but important thing that we really, it's really difficult to measure really well. So if we look at behaviors, and we can take things like, well, I have a tendency my sleep gets worse, I might have trouble falling to sleep, I might wake up in the night and not be able to get back to sleep. Some people binge eat at night or drink. So we have behaviors that are symptoms of stress, and we could measure those, but they're also influenced by so many other variables outside of our emotional and psychological well-being. So one that's become, we actually borrowed it from some of the marriage and family counseling research, and it's been used now to sort of as a little useful guide for what constitutes having, am I mentally healthy or am I having a good mental health week or day or month, is simply to take each day in turn and try and decide whether it's been a good day, a bad day, or an average neutral day. So it's neither good nor bad. Now that might seem ridiculously simple to do. Good day, bad day. And I'll tell you why we use this metric in a moment. Now, if you have trouble thinking, was today a good day? Well, I got a parking ticket, but I then did see a long lost friend. I haven't seen him for a while. So So what we try and have people do, if you can't come up with a blanket statement of was today good, bad, or neutral, you say, okay, what's the best thing that happened to you today? And what's the worst thing that happened to you today? You probe those things individually, you try and pit them against one another. Does that overshadow that or not? And still you come up with a conclusion. Okay, so I think today was actually a good day. Now you do that for a period. It could be a week or 2 weeks or even a month. And what we're actually looking for, and the research shows, that there's what we call a positivity ratio, right? We want the number of good days to outnumber the bad days by about 4 to 1, right? So if I look in my typical 2-week training schedule, and I have made a note of that, and I see, well, actually I'm having about as many good days as I am bad days. Mm-hmm. We consider that to be indicative of sort of mild dysfunction, actually. Mm-hmm. We want the tables to be turned in favor of more good days. If you have a negative ratio, I'm now having more bad days than I am good, this probably warrants a bit more intervention. So you actually need to be working on things for your mental health a bit more proactively, or seek help for that. But most of us, under sort of usual circumstances, you're not injured, you're not sort of self-isolating, you're not doing stuff. Most of us generally have about a 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 ratio. That's considered to be indicative. So it's quite an easy exercise for us all to do. And this is, and to borrow back from the couples, this is how we try and evaluate how healthy relationships are, right? Do you have, in your relationship, do you have good days, bad days, or neutral days? We want that ratio.
Are you asking me personally now? Here we go.
I know Liz, and I know what she would say.
Every day is a good day, Simon.
Every day is a good day.
Every day is a good day. I'm thinking just about some of the indicators that I might use for my, you know, physical health, but also the way in which I might be able to use, you know, some of that data that I might gain. Perhaps, you know, I go running, I'm using my Garmin, I get back, look at Garmin Connect, I review my data. Like, what is it that I can say, okay, when I look at these metrics, these are the key ones for me to gain this wider understanding of perhaps I should run more, or I should run less, like I should amp it up a little bit, or I should notch it down?
Well, the cornerstone of behavior change and behavioral science is self-monitoring, right? This is sort of a pillar. So we don't know how things are until we measure them. So we have to become a little bit better at not just being sort of writing things down, but being reflective about how we feel. And not many athletes or people actually do that. We're not encouraged to do it as children. We're not trained to do it, certainly. And many of us live quite a sort of a separate life from that emotional experience of the world. Or we do exercises or habits or behaviors to try and make bad feelings go away. But one of the things we need to do is be a little bit more sensitive and reflect about how we are feeling. So keeping a diary or a journal is a great opportunity to focus not on stats like pace and heart rates, but to focus on feeling states. So if I asked you to write down, tell me how today went for you, Martin, most of you, if you are like most people, you'll write down in a fairly sort of practical, physical way. You know, you'll give me things that you've done or accomplished or things that you haven't done. But there might be some element of, and that didn't make me feel good, or I'm still frustrated that I haven't been able to start that. I get so mad at myself because I'm such a procrastinator, right? So trying to keep a journal or a diary, but have more affect or mood related information in it. So now I say, I want you to keep the same journal, but now I only want you to describe how the things that you would have put down have made you feel, right? And the more we become sensitive to the feelings or mood states that we have, the more likely we are to notice patterns or trends. And the great thing about mood or emotion is that we can give them what psychologists awkwardly call valence, which is simply all emotions are either positive, negative, or neutral, right? There's no disagreement that being frustrated is a negative emotion, right? Or being angry is a negative emotion, or being happy or excited are positive emotions, right? Bored could be both positive and and negative. But suffice to say, we can put most of our emotions in this. So when you start to write down the words that describe how you feel in a given day, and you always do this at the end of the day looking back versus like in the moment, because our experiences, our emotional life is so heavily influenced by what we've just been doing, right? So if I write down how I feel after I've just come off a call with you, Martin, obviously I'm going to be saying, I've never felt so depressed. I've never felt happier and more excited to see you. So that won't be a good reflection of my overall day. So at the end of the day, I write down some words that describe my emotions that day. And I can literally put a positive, a negative, or a neutral sign next to them. I can even just count those up. If I choose to. But suffice to say, the important point is that we need to start to be a little bit more sensitive and reflective about how our feelings are across the day and trying to quantify them so I can know whether the good days are outweighing the bad days or vice versa.
Yeah, and sometimes that's harder to achieve, isn't it, than other days, you know? So being able to track that in some way, I guess, is a really helpful tool for us to do. Simon,
it
look,
is. Just... And I will say, if you get the tendency to, you know, they want you to circle a smiley face or a frowny face, the reason, that's still a great way of tracking mood, but the reason that doesn't work as well as forcing you to write is because it's a bit of a way out of actually having to be reflective over our feelings. I see a smiley face, oh, I know what that means, that's kind of me, versus no, I'm not going
to
give you anything.
I really need to think about this. Yeah.
Use your words, right?
Yeah.
And that's that act of reflecting consciously on what you're feeling is part of the process of being more emotionally literate.
Yeah. And that's so important. Although I think particularly at the moment, that's quite complicated because, you know, there's a lot happening in life generally at the moment, which I guess is why running, you know, back to the reason why we began the interview, running is such an important thing. You know, even if we are regular runners and we do tons already, or if we're sat thinking, I'm really not sure about whether or not to start on this running game. I'm hearing the advice from you is, look, just a little physical activity, a little exercise, some regular running, some regular routine can calm nerves, settle emotion, give you hope, help you deal with uncertainty. So it seems like a pretty good positive thing all around.
It really is, you know, reduces stress reactivity and these other things. But remember, we spoke about problem and emotion focused coping, and running is one of those few things or aerobic activities that does both. So most of us, if you're an athlete who's used to training, we use training and think of our exercise as a problem focused method. In other words, I've got races coming up, I want to be faster because I'll have better chances of doing well. Metrics that make me a better athlete. But we must never forget that the exercise also has a therapeutic effect for our mental health. It helps us cope emotionally. So now it's a switch of focus, a reframing. Yes, I get that this, to ask someone to go out, a runner, particularly someone who's training for a half or a full marathon, to go out and run for 15 minutes or 10 minutes, most of them will say, what's the point of doing that? I'm not going to get any training effect. What's the point unless I can run for at least an hour? We're forgetting because we're only focusing on that as a problem-focused method, not the emotion focus coping, and it works both sides. So this becomes now, and often we find it helps to have athletes, we designate sessions as a mental health run or a performance run or a training
run. So absolutely.
And even if it helps you to force yourself to understand the difference, guess what? You have a different kit that you wear depending on what role it's playing. To reinforce that the reason I'm doing this, the environment's slightly different, how I'm going to feel about this is different, and the role of it. And you may even decide not to focus on any of those quantifiable metrics during the run itself, because I'm just going to focus on the distraction, my interaction with the environment, and so on. Looking at an aesthetically pleasing environment makes us feel better, our mood changes, and so on. So yeah, thinking about it as a mental health run versus a performance run.
That's a really great tip. I think that's a fantastic one, you know, for us to close the conversation on, is the concept of designated mental health runs. Simon, been a pleasure as always to chat to you. Thanks for joining us for this Garmin Run 4 Q&A. It's been great.
My pleasure, Martin.